Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Supreme Court decisions around same-sex marriage and voting rights got widespread media attention. As a result, so many of the court's other decisions failed to receive the attention they deserve. The court issued rulings on so many cases regarding very important issues that affect all of us. Pharmaceutical companies, antitrust laws, credit card companies, class action lawsuits, affirmative action, the Indian Child Welfare Act, government surveillance, just to name a few of them. Nearly one-third of the cases were by a 5-4 vote with a split along party lines. The conservative 5-justice majority sided consistently with big business. The Chamber of Commerce prevailed in all 7 of the cases it filed, or in which it filed briefs. In a New York Times editorial on July 1st, Erwin Chemerinsky, professor at UCLA, wrote, quote, "The Supreme Court's momentous decisions last week on affirmative action, voting rights, and same-sex marriage overshadowed a disturbing trend. In the final 2 weeks of its term, the court ruled in favor of big business and closed the courthouse doors to employees, consumers, and small businesses seeking remedy for serious injuries," end quote. So on today's Your Call, we are going to talk about these undercovered decisions and find out how they will affect us in the years to come. And then also, what do these rulings say about the future of the court? Today, we are joined by Tejinder Singh, contributor to the SCOTUS blog and counsel with Goldstein and Russell. Tejinder has represented parties before the Supreme Court and lower courts in matters involving civil rights, financial regulation, privacy rights, environmental protection, intellectual property, and gaming law. And he joins us from Washington. Hi, Tejinder. Welcome to the show.
Hey, so great to be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Daniel Farber, professor of constitutional law at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law and author of Judgment Calls, Politics and Principle in Constitutional Law. And Daniel joins us from the studios of UC Berkeley. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be on.
Great to have you. So, Tejinder, let's start off with you. So many decisions. It's kind of overwhelming, actually, and it's amazing that a lot of them refused or did not get the attention they deserve. First off, what really struck you about this term? What stands out for you?
Well, this term, last term, was considered a blockbuster. You know, it concluded with the landmark decision on the Affordable Care Act, which I think was the closest the court has ever come to sort of flirting with real political peril. And we usually terms like that come along, you know, once every 4 or 5 years. And then this last term, we had another one. And as you noted, there were some real blockbuster cases regarding same-sex marriage, regarding the Voting Rights Act, regarding affirmative action. But those were just four of the 78 merits cases the court decided. When you look at just sort of the headline-grabbing issues that are sort of moving through the court with regularity now, it's really surprising. And for those of us who are in the court-covering business, it's also a lot of fun.
Sorry about the line. I think we might try to call you back, Tejinder. Daniel, what about you? What really strikes you about this term?
Well, I had a similar reaction to the blockbuster cases. It also seems to me more and more clear that it's not really the Roberts Court, the Chief Justice. In many ways, it's the Anthony Kennedy Court. He's the fifth member of nearly all of these 5-4 decisions. So in many ways, what we see come out of the court reflects his views more than anyone else's.
What about the quotes that I read about business? Georgetown professor David Cole says the decisions make it virtually impossible for citizens, victims of surveillance, and human rights victims to bring lawsuits in federal court. And then Erwin Chemerinsky says that the court ruled in favor of big business and closed the courthouse doors to employees, consumers, and small businesses seeking remedies. What are your thoughts on those quotes, Daniel?
Well, I guess there are two different ideas there. One is the attitude toward big business. I don't think that justices would imagine themselves to be partial to big business, but the majority do have a very strong inclination toward believing in free markets, to being skeptical of litigation and regulation as ways of controlling business. And that translates, I think, into results that favor big business. In terms of access to the courthouse, I think that's maybe a little overstated, but basically right. The court generally has closed the doors to the courthouse on many different dimensions using legal doctrines in a way that makes it much harder for people with a grievance to get into court. And we saw that in a number of cases in this last term.
Tejinder, we were just talking about the quotes from Erwin Chemerinsky and David Cole, and it is striking that the Chamber of Commerce prevailed in all seven of the cases in which it filed briefs. Do you agree with their assessments that the courthouse doors are now closed to citizens, employees, and small businesses?
Well, I think to say that the courthouse doors are closed is a mild exaggeration, but only a mild one, and the reason why is that, you know, the court seems to be moving toward a posture where, you know, its desired approach is that lawsuits that it considers to be meritless should be ended as quickly as possible. And in the time that since Chief Justice Roberts became Chief Justice Roberts, the court has made it harder to plead cases successfully, and it's also made it harder to generally to assert standing to bring the cases. And these are sort of gatekeeping functions of the federal courts. They try to get rid of the cases as early as possible. And yeah, it has become significantly harder. And the people who tend to suffer as a result are, you know, the little guy, which could be employees, it could be customers. And larger entities tend to do better with these more difficult rules.
Well, let's dive in and talk about the case of the FTC versus Activis. Is that how you say it? Activis?
Activis.
Activis. Okay. So this is an incredible case, and I urge all of you to go to our website and look at the photo of this woman that we're going to be talking about. So in 2004, Karen Bartlett went to the doctor for a sore shoulder and was prescribed the generic anti-inflammatory drug Celindac, which is manufactured by Mutual Pharmaceutical. 3 weeks after she took the drug, she began suffering from a disease called toxic epidermal necrolysis. I believe that's how you say it. The condition is really painful, and it caused her skin to peel off, exposed raw flesh, third-degree burns. The drug left her disabled and nearly blind. Tejinder, can you tell us what happened after that?
Yeah, sure. So just to be clear, this case is Mutual Pharmaceutical versus Bartlett, not FTC versus FTC.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got that one wrong. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so the way the case went is she brought a products liability claim in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire has a version of what's called strict liability, which means that you don't have to be negligent, you don't have to intentionally do anything wrong to be liable. Instead, if a jury finds that your product is unreasonably dangerous, then you are always liable for any damage caused by the product. And New Hampshire law gives some guidance as to why you would find a product unreasonably dangerous. One thing you can do to mitigate the danger from your product is you can warn people about how dangerous it is. At the time that Ms. Bartlett bought Celindac and used it, there were no warnings about the type of condition that could develop as a side effect that she suffered. It's also known as Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And so she brought a lawsuit, and she said, this product is unreasonably dangerous, and you've got to pay me. And the New Hampshire courts agreed. She was awarded $21 million in damages. And the pharmaceutical company took its case to the Supreme Court, arguing that basically federal food and drug law, the regulations by the FDA, the fact that they had approved the drug and were requiring it to be manufactured and labeled a certain way, made it so that state law couldn't afford any relief to Ms. Bartlett. And the argument goes, and this is a general principle in all of law, when state law and federal law conflict, federal law wins. And so the question for the Supreme Court was, does the state law actually really conflict with the federal law? Is the state's requirement that you pay money to people who suffer side effects from unreasonably dangerous drugs, is that in conflict with the federal rules saying that generic drugs have to work a certain way? And the Supreme Court held that it was. In a 5-4 decision by Justice Alito, the Supreme Court said, this is really an attempt to say that the generic drug manufacturer can't make a product the way the FDA said that it has to, and you're not allowed to do that.
Tim O'Brien, an attorney with Levin Papantonio, who practices in the areas of pharmaceutical and drug litigation, says, quote, the majority opinion in Bartlett turns 100 years of American jurisprudence on its ear. A manufacturer brings a product to market and creates a risk for consumers. That risk must be shared by the consumer and the manufacturer, which profits from the distribution of that risk. The Alito majority gave the generic drug manufacturers a permanent get-out-of-jail-free card. End quote. What are your thoughts on that, Daniel?
Well, I think it may be a little bit of an overstatement, but again, I think there's a grain of truth. When Congress passed these laws, I don't think that it crossed their mind that the result would be to eliminate the right of victims of unsafe products to get redress. And what happened, but they did want to eliminate certain kinds of regulation by the states that might conflict with the FDA. And the Supreme Court took what I now think looks like a fatal step of deciding that lawsuits are a form of regulation, and then they've gone after them in the same way. So we're left in a position where the FDA is the only place where you can bring claims about product safety, at least for generics, and where people who are injured, if the FDA makes a mistake or if there's new information that comes to light, can't get any compensation. I think the FDA is actually considering some steps that would affect this particular case or cases like it in the future, by giving generic manufacturers more of an ability to change the labels. The court's reasoning was that under the law, the manufacturer had no control over what was on the label, and therefore it was unfair, really, to hold them responsible for not giving a better warning. And so we may see some adjustment in this particular holding, but it is part of a trend, especially for pharmaceuticals, to relieve drug companies of liability.
And what does this mean for people who have side effects in the future? Because hundreds of drugs are currently being investigated across the country. I mean, is it just good luck? You're on your own? Let's hope nothing happens to you?
Well,
yeah,
I think that is
essentially what it means, at least insofar as it relates to generic drug manufacturers. Now, there are other steps that can be taken. You know, if a drug really is very dangerous, you know, the FDA might pull its approval. But the real question is, you know, if you've already suffered side effects, you know, what can happen to you? You know, you may have recourse against certain others. You may be able to sue a prescribing doctor for malpractice, for example. That wouldn't affect drug liability, but that would depend on the law of your particular state. Vis-a-vis the generic drug manufacturers, it seems to be the case that, as of now, you cannot bring a claim that says they failed to warn you, and if the design defect claim you bring has an element of, you know, considers the warnings, then you're probably out of luck.
Have you all seen the photos of Karen Bartlett?
Yes, I have.
I mean, her face is just completely disfigured. And again, go to our website, yourcallradio.org, and we'll post a story about Karen Bartlett and her case. And I mean, when you step back from this, how significant is this case? What would you say, Daniel? I mean, it seems like it's a huge deal.
Well, I think it's very significant, at least in terms of defects in drugs that don't appear before the generics come on the market. One of the problems is that it puts complete reliance on the FDA to worry about these issues. But the FDA has problems of its own. They've got budget limitations. They're not very good about checking on drugs after they come on the market. They're under a lot of pressure to make approval or disapproval very quickly. And so as a result, the FDA watchdog may not be capable of fully protecting the public. And now we're also losing the ability to rely on lawsuits when problems come to light later on.
And again, that case, and thanks for correcting me. I have so many cases in front of me that were undercovered. I got it mixed up. Mutual Pharmaceutical versus Bartlett. And be sure to read about this story and what this woman had to go through for taking a generic drug for something as basic as shoulder pain. On today's Your Call, we are talking about Supreme Court decisions, focusing specifically on the undercovered decisions. As you know, same-sex marriage, voting rights got so much attention. Affirmative action got a bit of attention. But there were so many other very important cases that really didn't get the attention they deserved. So we're going to be talking about those today, and we're going to talk about what these decisions say about the future of the court, because so many of the justices are very young, so they will be on the court for decades to come. And what stood out for you this term? What questions do you have? Maybe you heard about a case involving workers' rights or small businesses, Indian Child Welfare Act. Are there any questions you have that you feel didn't get answered? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. What are your thoughts on this term and the Supreme Court decisions? Today, we're joined by Tejinder Singh, contributor at SCOTUS blog and counsel with Goldstein and Russell. He's represented parties before the Supreme Court and lower courts in matters involving civil rights, financial regulation, privacy rights, environmental protection, intellectual property, and gaming law. Daniel Farber is professor of constitutional law at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law, and he's the author of the book Judgment Calls, Politics and Principle in Constitutional Law. All right, so let's go to another really interesting case that actually did get some coverage locally because it's a local case, American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant. So some background here. Restaurant owners were disgruntled about high credit card fees from American Express, but the cost of bringing an antitrust case was incredibly expensive for each individual merchant. There were some restaurants in the East Bay who got involved. So they brought a class action suit, even though the terms of the agreement with American Express prohibited merchants from forming a class action. Daniel, did you follow this one closely?
Yeah, I did.
Can you give us a little more background on this case?
Well, this is one of the many cases involving the ability to bring statutory claims into either arbitration or get judicial relief. And I think what we see in this case is the court's a real affection, you might almost say, for arbitration. They really would, I think, ideally like to see no lawsuits at all in federal court. Everything goes to arbitration. I mean, it's kind of an ironic position that judges seem to want to put themselves out of business. But in any possible way, they want things to go to arbitration, and they really have very little interest in worrying about the fairness of the arbitration process.
So this was a 5-3 decision, and Justice Scalia said American Express can use its arbitration agreement to squelch the class action claim from the restaurants, even if the dominant credit card company is violating antitrust laws and the class suit is the only affordable way to raise the claim. Tejinder, what did you make of this decision?
I think this is the sort of sleeper giant of the term. You know, it's gotten a little bit of play, but I think it's actually a very, very important decision. So the way these agreements work, it's a merchant agreement between American Express and all of these merchants, you know, restaurants, shops, you name it. And this agreement has a provision called an arbitration clause, which says, you know, if we get in a fight about the terms of this agreement or any facet of our business, it's going to go to arbitration, not a court. And by the way, the arbitration can't be done on a class-wide basis. And so you've got this agreement that says basically if you want to bring a claim against us, you have to do it in arbitration and you have to do it one merchant at a time, right? And the court says that's absolutely fine, nothing wrong with this agreement. Now, what's tricky about this and the reason why it has tremendous implications for the economy generally is you often have these businesses like American Express that are gigantic. And they're dealing with businesses that are relatively small, like Italian Colors Restaurant. And the big business has most of the power in the negotiating relationship. I mean, if you've ever, you know, accepted changes to the terms and conditions on iTunes, you sort of know how this works. You're always just sort of accepting the deal that they give you, and you have no power to negotiate for a better deal. And so these types of agreements, you know, they're not just between credit card companies and merchants. They're really between consumers and businesses, you know, small businesses and big businesses, and so on and so forth. They really run a lot of our modern economy. And what the court essentially held was the bigger business has a lot of power to dictate the terms on which people might be able to challenge its behavior.
The dissent was written by Justice Kagan, and she wrote, quote, "So if the arbitration clause is enforceable, Amex has insulated itself from antitrust liability, even if it has, in fact, violated the law. The monopolist gets to use its monopoly power to insist on a contract, effectively depriving its victims of all legal recourse." And here, she wrote, is the nutshell version of today's opinion. Admirably flaunted rather than camouflaged, too darn bad. I mean, to Ginger, she's really sending a strong message with this this dissent.
Yeah, she does that. Justice Kagan, in her short time on the court, has, I think, established herself as one of the clearest and wittiest writers on the court. You know, and as you mentioned, there are some justices on the court who will be around for quite some time, and I think she's one of them. And she sort of stands out as a voice among the liberal justices on the court for her willingness to sort of distill cases to their essence in very plain English and put her descriptions out there. And I think that her description is, it's hard to quibble with in this case.
Media Matters took a look at media coverage of this very important decision and found that with the exception of one brief non-primetime mention on CBS, not one cable or network evening news show addressed this decision. Tejinder, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, this is really important.
Yeah, I think it is a very important decision. You know, the decision was handed down, I believe, around June 20th, and the term ended June 26th. So we were in that last week of the term where decisions were just coming down at a breakneck pace. And, you know, this case, although I think it is very important for the way the economy works, is not sexy, per se. And I think that to the extent that it was swept under the rug, that's one reason. I think it's also the case, you know, one important fact to note is that Visa and MasterCard are engaged in similar litigation with their merchants, and they didn't have a similar class-wide arbitration waiver. So to some extent, the damage from this decision at present is limited to what's going on with American Express. On the other hand, it really draws a roadmap for every big business for how they should be drafting their contracts going forward.
And Daniel, before we go to break, any final thoughts on how this decision affects citizens and small businesses?
Well, I think it's part of a sort of gradual campaign on the part of the court majority to make it harder for people to assert their rights under federal law. These cases don't just involve whether the agreement has been violated, but whether the business has actually been engaging in conduct that's illegal and even conceivably criminal under the federal antitrust laws. And the court has made it clear that they really just don't care much one way or the other about whether there's a remedy.
All right. And again, that case is American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant. They're actually located in Oakland. And this is a very important decision. You can read about it at yourcallradio.org. And today we are talking about the Supreme Court and undercovered decisions. Same-sex marriage, voting rights got a lot of attention, but so many other decisions affecting generic drugs, antitrust laws, class action lawsuits, patents, the Indian Child Welfare Act did not get the attention they deserve, and we'll be talking about more after a break.
You're listening to Your Call here on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, please send a message to your email, that is, to feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Mm-hmm.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the conditions inside California's prisons. The huge hunger strike began on Monday. California inmates are refusing to eat to protest solitary confinement and torture. And we also just learned, thanks to the Center for Investigative Reporting, that California prisons sterilized nearly 150 female inmates from 2006 to 2010. So we'll be talking about conditions, and we'll talk about this protest tomorrow. And then on Friday, we will talk about media coverage of conditions inside prison, specifically the sterilization. We will also talk about the hunger strike at Guantanamo. A judge recently said that President Obama has the power to stop forced feeding at Guantanamo. So we'll also talk about that on Friday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Supreme Court and undercovered decisions affecting everything from, you know, what rights do you have if you take a generic drug and you get some side effects that possibly were not on the bottle? What rights do you have as a small business to sue a large business? We'll talk about the Indian Child Welfare Act, government surveillance. There were so many decisions that really didn't get the attention they deserved. Nearly one-third of the cases were by a 5-4 vote with a split along party lines. The conservative five-justice majority sided consistently with big business. The Chamber of Commerce prevailed in all 7 of the cases in which it filed briefs. So what questions do you have? What do you think this tells us about the future of the courts? Today we're joined by Tejinder Singh, contributor to the SCOTUS blog and counsel with Goldstein and Russell. Daniel Farber is professor of constitutional law at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law and author of the book Judgment Calls, Politics and Principle in Constitutional Law. And you can join us 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
I'm calling about the decision on the generic drugs. From experience of ordering generic drugs, I was alarmed, and it should be a note of caveat emptor to all consumers now, that there is no protection, and price is not going to be a yielding decision to purchase drugs for safety. A point of fact was a 20-year-old drug that's been out suddenly was, and it's popular, it's called Asacol. It has been yanked off the shelf because of a term called teratogenicity, or in other words, fetal mutations. And they've substituted it with an item that's 8 times the cost. So naturally, consumers will then go over the Canadian border to go shop. Mm. Not all the Canadian people, companies are offering that kind of field testing for the drugs they offer. They're just working off a profit and loss. So if there's no way of suing, there's no loss. There, in other words, if they don't see a customer a market falling, they're obviously just going to sell low-grade products. The only one that I have found up in Canada was Jan Drugs. They only carry Tier 1. That's a term that seems to be used in the generic market. Tier 1 means that they're tested about every 3 months and renewed testing so that you will get products from Singapore, Turkey, and India that don't fall under those criteria.
Well, thank you for the call. We'll get a comment in just a minute, but we have a related call from William in San Francisco. And if you can speak up, William, I understand your line is kind of quiet. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. On the first case, the Steven Johnson syndrome, I believe I heard that the drug company was not responsible for the labeling, what was on the labeling of the product. Is that correct?
Tejinder, can you clarify that for us?
Yeah, so this is a rule that arises in the context of generic drugs only. The way that drug approval works with the FDA is that when you bring a new drug to market, you have to go through a very, very comprehensive review process in order to get it on the market. And Congress passed a statute which was designed to make it easier for generic drugs to get approved after a brand name version had already been approved. And the way you get generic drug approval is basically all you have to show is that your drug is chemically identical to the brand name drug and that your label is identical to the label that's been approved for the brand name drug. But once you get that approval, you're not allowed to change anything about the generic. You know, the manufacturer can't change anything. It has to stay as it was at the time it was approved. And so when Daniel said earlier that the generic manufacturer doesn't have control over the label, he's right. Generic drug manufacturers cannot change the label once it's approved.
For the labeling, and who can the patient go after?
So I think the answer is that the patient can't necessarily go after anybody for the labeling. As to who's responsible, you know, it would be the FDA for approving the label in the first instance, and, you know, it's their judgment call that that label was adequate. And I think that this really highlights a point that Daniel made earlier that's a very good point, which is that this decision has effectively put all of our fates in the hands of the FDA to get this process right, to have access to the best information, and that may be a tall order for the agency.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, William. You know, this drug decision has really prompted a lot of people to call. I think we're going to have to do another show about pharmaceuticals because it's been a while. But let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I don't know the particulars of this case, but I do know that Sulindac is a cheap drug that is somewhat effective against cancer. And so if you start taking off any drug that's had a bad reaction with people, you would basically take away all cheap drugs from the general population. I mean, people have bad effects sometimes with ibuprofen or even aspirin. And so it's, unless the drug company's done something negligent, if they're using the same chemical formulation of Sulindac, I'm not sure why the drug company should be held responsible in this case. I'm definitely not for any drug, you know, companies poisoning people or anything like that, but I'm afraid if they start taking off cheap drugs that people really need and use, that wouldn't be good either.
Well, they're not, Tejinder, they're not taking the drug off the market, right?
Well, that's correct. So I think the real question that you have to figure out the answer to is, let's accept for a moment that the drug is beneficial to some users. And let's also accept, as we must, that it will have catastrophic side effects for some other users. The real question is, who should have to pay when those side effects occur? And under New Hampshire law, the answer was the drug company pays. You know, when you cause catastrophic side effects to someone, you have to compensate that person. And what the federal, what the Supreme Court essentially held was that that provision of New Hampshire law was inconsistent with the federal rule requiring the drugs to be labeled and produced a certain way and therefore is inoperative. And unfortunately, there is no federal counterpart that defines who gets to pay. So under the situation we have now, it's the patient who pays. And so I think the judgment call you have to make is not necessarily should the drug be pulled or should the drug not be pulled. The judgment call you have to make is what's better? Is it better for drug companies to bear the cost of these side effects, or is it better for patients to do it?
All right. Well, thank you for the calls, and we'll definitely add a show about pharmaceuticals to our list. I'll bring that up at our next meeting. Thank you for the calls on that. Let's switch gears and talk about adoptive couple versus baby girl, a minor child under the age of 14 years. This was a heart-wrenching case. A divided Supreme Court ruled that the parental rights of a Native American father may be terminated if he's failed to establish a history of, quote, continued custody of his biological child. Tejinder, do you want to start off by giving us some background on adoptive couple versus baby girl?
Sure. So this is, as you say, it's a heart-wrenching case. And the way the fact emerged, there was a Native American man who fathered a child with a woman who was not Native American. and the mother, and they were not together at the time. And she asked if he would be willing to pay child support, and he, or whether he would prefer instead to surrender his parental rights. And he responded that, that he would rather surrender his parental rights. This was apparently done all via text message. The woman was not able to take care of the child, and so she put the girl up for adoption. And she was adopted by a family who, by all accounts, you know, loved her very much. When the father heard of this, he came back and attempted to stop the adoption and was actually awarded custody of his daughter. And he raised her, and there's no dispute that they've had a good, you know, father-daughter relationship for a period of a couple of years now. But the case went to litigation, and the issue deals with a statute called the Indian Child Welfare Act. Now, this is a law that was passed, I believe, in the 1970s for the purpose of stopping the breakup of Indian families. There was this widespread pattern of social workers and others placing Indian children for adoption outside of the tribes, you know, and there was a real concern that this was going to lead to the collapse of Indian tribes and of the tribal culture. And so, consequently, Congress passed a law, and one thing that it says is that, you know, an adoption, you know, there are a few provisions, but one of them is that if you have continuing custody over the child, your parental rights, you know, cannot be terminated under state law. And so this case, and of course, parental rights need to be terminated before an adoption can be finalized. So the question in this case was whether the Indian Child Welfare Act applies to this father. And the Supreme Court essentially held, no, it doesn't. Not because he's not a parent within the meaning of the statute, but because he did not have continuing custody over her. So the statute's goal, which is to prevent the breakup of existing families, wasn't implicated.
And it's interesting because he has since filed custody adoption papers. So he's now trying to adopt his own daughter.
Yeah, that's a weird quirk of the case. So there's another provision of the Indian Child Welfare Act that says that in any adoption proceedings involving an Indian child, there's an order of priority that must be honored. And the top are the child's parents, and then the child's Indian family. And then it goes down, and actually before you get to sort of general members of the public, you know, members of any Indian tribe get priority. And this is a fixed priority that can't be disregarded by state adoption agencies. And so it looks like, you know, even though the Supreme Court held that his parental rights could be terminated so that she wouldn't be treated as his daughter, you know, just by virtue of having actually being his daughter, he could become her adoptive father instead.
And Daniel, have you followed this case? What does this mean for Indian families?
Well, I think this particular ruling is fairly narrow. We have a case where where first of all the tribal member is the father, not the mother, and where the father really didn't take any steps at the time the child was born to create a parental relationship. So I think that narrows the case somewhat. I think you do see in the majority opinion maybe a certain amount of discomfort with the law. And with the court repeats a couple of times that, in fact, the child's Indian ancestry is very slight because the father had only, I think, some great-grandparents maybe who were Indians, although he then became an enrolled member of the tribe. And I think that the court has a sense that maybe the law has been applied at least in a way that goes well beyond the original purpose, which was to keep state social workers and other people from breaking up Indian families and putting the children up for adoption.
All right, and you can read more about that case, Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about undercover Supreme Court decisions, what these decisions tell us about the future of the court. What questions do you have about cases that you maybe heard a little bit about but want more information on? You could give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Daniel Farber, professor of constitutional law at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law, author of Judgment Calls, Politics and Principle in Constitutional Law. Tejinder Singh is a contributor to the SCOTUS blog and counsel with Goldstein and Russell. We've got an email from Jason in Lafayette who says, has Congress overturned many Roberts Court statutory interpretation decisions? The 2009 Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act is an example, overturning a 2007 opinion. It was President Obama's first bill signed into law. Daniel, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think the Congress will take action on any of these?
I think if you asked whether Congress was going to take action about anything of any kind, the answer would have to be that these days, who knows? Congress seems to be so deadlocked that they aren't very active. But I would say in terms of overruling statutory interpretations, there have been some studies that show that Congress actually intervenes pretty rarely. So that even though in theory the Congress has the final word, but in practice it's often the Supreme Court that does have the final word about the interpretation and application of federal laws.
And Tejinder, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, the Ledbetter case and then the statute are a really good example. That was a statute dealing with Title VII, unemployment discrimination statute, where the court basically held the claims are going to be barred if they're not brought within a certain time period, and Congress sort of changed the law to make it easier to bring those claims. There were two Title VII decisions toward the end of this term, both of which went in the employer's favor. And Justice Ginsburg read a dissent from the bench where at the close of her dissenting statement, she said, she referenced the Ledbetter decision, and she said, you know, Congress, the ball is in your court again. You really ought to be fixing the court's mistakes. But I tend to agree with Daniel that Congress doing things is not really something that they're into these days.
Was Ginsburg, right, was Ginsburg referring to Vance versus Ball State University? By chance?
Yeah, that one and the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center case. These were two cases both involving basically when employees can sue their employers for harassment and discrimination in the workplace.
Okay, so let's talk about that one because it's really important. Matea Vance sued her employer, Ball State University, for workplace harassment by a supervisor. Think Progress is calling this case the, quote, scariest Supreme Court case that you've probably never heard of, end quote. And according to Think Progress, this case makes it easier for many people's bosses to racially or sexually harass them and get away with it. Though the law provides fairly robust protection to workers harassed by their supervisors, the court's 5-4 decision defined the term, quote, supervisor very narrowly. Under the decision, your boss is only your supervisor if they have the power to make a, quote, significant change in your employment status, such as hiring, firing, failing to promote, reassignment with significantly different responsibilities, or a decision causing a significant change in benefits, end quote. Daniel, have you followed this closely? Can you give us a little background on this case?
Well, I think this is an issue that's come up under many federal laws, and usually federal law defines the idea of a supervisor much more broadly. For example, supervisors can't form labor unions under the National Labor Relations Act, and the definition of a supervisor there is, I think, significantly broader. So this is really a very narrow interpretation that I think really tells people in many situations that if you've got a complaint about harassment, you have to take it to some kind of internal company or government grievance unit and try to get it worked out within the company, but you're not going to be able to go to court.
And in this case, Vance sued because she said she was discriminated against due to her race. What else can you tell us about this to gender? And do you agree with Think Progress that this is one of the scariest cases you've probably never heard of?
Well, obviously a pretty extreme statement. Let's talk about the case, and we can figure out together whether it is.
Okay.
The way it works is this one was a kitchen employee at Ball State University, and she'd been working there for about a decade. She was the only African-American woman in the department, and she claimed that several of her coworkers, including one who she regarded as her supervisor, slapped her, used racial epithets referring to her, accosted her on occasion physically, and she complained to the employer. The employer apparently took some corrective action, but not a ton, and she was concerned that it was still continuing. So she brought a lawsuit under Title VII, which is a lawsuit that protects you from two kinds of adverse employment actions. The first is, failure to hire you on the basis of race or gender, fire you, promote, things like that. It also protects you from what's called a hostile work environment, so, being harassed at the workplace. And third, it protects you from retaliation. If you make a complaint under Title VII, you're protected from retaliation for that. And it's a very important employment discrimination statute. It's really the cornerstone of federal regulation for employment discrimination. And so she brings this claim, and basically the Supreme Court throws it out because they say, this woman was not really your supervisor. She didn't have a sort of degree of formal power over you. In fact, she looks a lot more like your coworker to you, and you can't sue your employer just because a coworker is harassing you. You have to show that the employer sort of had a real hand in it. And I think that this is a very important decision in this field because what it does is it insulates the employer at the top from the actions of, employees who are discriminating in the workplace, who are violating the norms set by Title VII, and it insulates that employer from any financial liability and thereby might decrease the incentive the employer has to really get involved to regulate this conduct in the first place. And so, yeah, I think it is, it's a very important decision. It will affect sort of everyone who works for a medium to large size company in the United States. It remains to be seen just exactly how scary the consequences will be. I think there are other reasons why employers would want to limit this kind of terrible harassment in the workplace. It's scary.
Well, and you can read also more about this one at our website, yourcallradio.org. A number of women's groups say the decisions ignore the reality of the workplace and the ways in which discrimination and harassment play out every day. We've got just about 3 minutes left, and I'm wondering, is there any case that you both have been closely following that you're interested in that really didn't get much play? Daniel, what were you following this term?
Well, I thought the Clapper case, which was about electronic surveillance, was a case that got a little bit of media attention, but not as much as it should have, because, again, it was a case where the court closed the courthouse door and said that really there was no way, at least in most circumstances, for anyone to go to court to try to get a ruling about the government's very broad surveillance of the public. Just by coincidence, shortly after that, we started learning a lot more about government surveillance and just how widespread it's become. And it looks like the courts are going to be pretty much powerless to do anything if the surveillance is violating the Constitution.
Wow. I mean, this is very significant because they struck down the Fourth Amendment challenge to FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, right?
Right, or at least to the amendments to FISA.
The Fourth,
yes.
Right. And so it's interesting that this, with all this talk about Snowden, that this isn't being connected because, I mean, it's very connected. The courts ruled that civil rights groups that challenged the law did not have standing because they couldn't prove they were actually being spied on.
So there is actually a development related to that case. which has occurred in the last week. There's a group called the Electronic Privacy Information Center, also known as EPIC, and they have filed a special application with the Supreme Court. The normal process is, you know, you go to the lower federal courts and you appeal and you petition for Supreme Court review. They filed an application directly with the Supreme Court, which is an extraordinary application, saying we want to basically bring back the same claim as from the Clapper case. And as support for their standing, their ability to bring the claim, they're using a document that Snowden leaked, which is an opinion of the Foreign Surveillance Court saying, you know, that Verizon customers, that Verizon will hand over information relating to its customers. And so EPIC is saying, we're a Verizon customer, so we have standing to bring the claim now. And they're trying to get it directly before the Supreme Court. And we're at the SCOTUS blog, we're following this case in more or less real time as it progresses.
All right. Well, and we've got a minute left. Because a lot of the justices, I can think of just five, who are pretty young, they're going to be on the court for decades to come. Daniel, just quickly, what do these rulings tell you about the future of the court?
Well, one thing I would say is we can't really be sure. We do have a number of young justices, but we've also got some pretty senior justices. Justice Ginsburg, Justice Scalia is getting along in years. Because the court's so closely divided, if, for example, if Justice Scalia were to unexpectedly leave the court and Obama got to make a replacement, that could really have an enormous impact. But with that caveat, I would say this is going to be a conservative court unless something changes for a long time.
And it seems highly unlikely that Scalia would leave under Obama, right?
I think not voluntarily.
Yeah. Well, he shouldn't take any generic drugs if he has any health issues, that's for sure. Well, thank you so much. I know you did so much research to join us today and talk about these cases. Tejinder Singh is contributor with the SCOTUS blog. Daniel Farber is professor of constitutional law at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What are the conditions inside California's prisons, and what's being done about them? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the hunger strike that California inmates began on Monday to protest solitary confinement and torture. According to the Center for Investigative Reporting, California prisons sterilized nearly 150 female inmates from 2006 to 2010 without approvals. So what else do we need to know about conditions, and how effective has the hunger strike been so far? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.